The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
Here we are. It's episode number 500 of The Disciplined Investor Podcast. Andrew Horowitz here, and I am your host. And I've been your host since, it looks like, early 2007. March 2007 marked the first episode of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. And many of you have been here all the way through. And I thought today what we'd do is put aside some of the market talk, put aside some of the economic discussion, and focus in on the last, 10 years. 10 years. You know, some people say, well, we were one of the first and maybe even the pioneers of financial podcasts back when it wasn't in vogue. In the last few years, we've seen an incredible acceptance and excitement that has been generated around podcasting as a source of information, entertainment, and overall enjoyment for a lot of people. So I want to thank you so much for being there. And what I thought we'd do today is take a look back and walk through memory lane and go back to some of my favorite episodes of the last 10 years. We have had guests on from all walks of life, from all areas of finance, many different disciplines, whether it's technical analysis, fundamental analysis, specialists in economics, politics, areas about currencies and trading, just from anywhere that you can imagine. I have tried over the last decade, crazy how that sounds, the last decade, to bring some really good and educational resources to the show. So hopefully you'll enjoy some of the things that I picked out. I went through the hundreds of different episodes and tried to figure out, well, what was interesting? Who could we bring on? We're going to talk and bring back Andrew Ross Sorkin, Robert Reich, Jack Schwager, Mark Faber. And I want you to listen in on some of these. I thought it was really a lot of fun going back to, we went back as far as 2007. Back to 2007. Now, there's no particular order, but I thought we'd start off with a discussion that we had with Andrew Ross Sorkin. Now, this was before he was with CNBC. He was with the Wall Street Journal, New York Times at the time. And you can listen in on this when I pressed him on whether or not he was being groomed for a permanent position as an anchor. We had a discussion first, but then I talked to him a little bit about this and he really had nothing to say. But so here we go with Andrew Ross Sorkin. This was episode number 211 from May 2011.
We said that we were going to have a few times and a few things happened. Andrew Ross Sorkin from the New York Times is here, also a frequent guest and commentator on CNBC, as well as the author of the book, Too Big to Fail, and coming very shortly, the movie. I'm sorry, Andrew, by the way, I'm sorry I couldn't play that part that you'd asked me to for the movie.
I know. You know, Curtis Hanson, the director, was very upset about that. We had to get a whole casting director involved to try to find somebody else. What a mess. But thank you for considering it. I know your agent passed, so I appreciate that.
Yeah. Hey, so let's talk about a few things. Your book, Too Big to Fail, which was a big piece. It's heavy. It's big. It's because it has a lot of unbelievable insight into the whole banking mess that went on. And you were so embroiled in that. That was like a 24/48/7 kind of thing going on back then, right?
Oh, no. I mean, I still think it was the most important moment in our economic history, at least in the past, 50, 60 years, if not in the past century. I mean, I think that September of 2008 is one of those moments that we will be studying for many, many years. And that's why, HBO spent time trying to turn the book into a film.
Yeah. So one of the things I want to ask you is, in the book, you were so detailed and you had so many conversations that were quoted. As I was reading it, I was like, how did you know that? How did you know that stuff?
Right. So I spent about a year interviewing over 200 of the principals for over 500 hours. And I would literally sit with my tape recorder for hours and hours and hours. And I would literally ask, the big issue questions, but I'd also ask the little issue questions. What were you eating? What were you doing at the time? What did you say to him? How did he say it back? And I would literally compare the notes and go back and forth between all the participants. And oftentimes, you know, if there were if there were 10 people in the room, I would talk to 9 of them, if not 10.
Right.
And so you were really to recreate what happened in the room. And to me, you know, in retrospect, it's very easy to sort of decide who's wearing the white hat and who's wearing the black hat and what you think of history. But I think when you can get inside the room, when you get behind the headlines, when you can actually see what people were saying and doing and understand the decisions that were being made and what the opportunities were, meaning, you know, what was on offer. Oftentimes today, I think we look back and we're upset about this or that, but it's often a false choice.
Mm-hmm.
When you actually see what the choices were that were available at the time, I think it may change your perspective.
Yeah. So, you know, I think you were young at the time. You're young now. I think you graduated like college at like 13 or something, right?
Not Doogie Howser, but I graduated in 1999.
Okay, well, 1999. So the thing is, you were still, I mean, really, you were young, and you were. I mean, you're a very bright guy. I'm not trying to, you know, butt you up here, but
and you were
able to actually get into that quote unquote club. Right. Obviously, you had credentials behind you with the Times and all that, but you really got some, I mean, just unfettered access to a lot of that. But looking back on now you got the book out. Back on it from this point right now, do you think that there's, you know, kind of this clear sailing that is being told to us by many of the powers that be, or is there the banking system still a mess?
Oh, no, not at all. I think that the banking system is a disaster.
Yeah.
I think the too big to fail is too big to fail squared. You know, you look now, top 10 banks control 75% of all banking assets. Think about that.
Yeah.
I think the Dodd-Frank legislation does, I don't want to say next to nothing, but really only gets at the issues around the edges. We still are living with too big to fail.
Yeah.
But I would say that the greatest lesson, actually, this whole project, in a way, is not only that these firms are too big to fail, but that ultimately, because I look at this as a human drama and as a story about people, they're too big to manage.
Mm.
That's the problem, actually.
Right.
When you think of institutions that are this disparate, with this many products, with this many complicated things going on, the idea that one individual who's the CEO is going to somehow understand it, or frankly, a dozen people on the board or even in the management committee is going to really be able to appreciate all these various issues, it's impossible. You know, and there's some great CEOs who came up through the trading side. They understand trading. They don't understand banking. There's some great people who've come through the banking side, understand banking. They don't understand trading. You know, there's some people coming through the wealth management side who are great marketers. I'm not sure they understand banking or trading.
Right.
It's a really complicated thing. You know, I was with, I was up at GE, I don't know when this was, 6-8 months ago, and I was thinking to myself, there are 17 board members at GE, and I know it's not a financial services company, though obviously half of it almost became one with GE Capital. And you think to yourself, this is a company that has 287,000 employees around the world. There's 17 people on the board.
Right.
Do you actually think these 17 people could possibly understand what's happening inside this company?
Well, and top it off,
it's impossible.
What's really interesting is that we always talk about the Fed and all that. We talk about Bernanke, like he's the only one doing anything. You know, he's the only, I mean, there's an entire group, more than a group, I mean, teams and teams of people at the Feds and all that, that are providing information. But I want to skip over to something, because back in the day when the banks were doing what they were doing and we were all about, and still are all about, you know, a confidence game, making sure the stress tests look good and making sure that this guy didn't fail and making sure that, you know, AIG didn't fail because then Goldman would fail, et cetera. That is being played out right now in Europe, don't you think?
Oh, I think it's being played out in Europe. And by the way, you know, forget about the banks. It's being played out in Europe on a much grander scale. You know, when I started this project and this book, I remember going to the editors talking about this phrase, too big to fail. They actually thought it was a bad idea for a title of a book. Now we use that phrase in the context not of financial institutions, but countries in Europe. And that's where this is, you know, and it's a debt problem. It's the same problem. In a way, it's sort of the banking problem on steroids. So
yeah.
I look at the European problem as the problem today.
Yeah.
But I also think it's a prelude for what ultimately could be our problem.
Well, what the thing about, I'll mention this last point, I know we have limited time, but one of the things that really troubled me last week, there was actually a clear and, I think, concise a summary of what was going on when we hear, for example, Portugal says, we don't need a bailout. And 3 days later, they get a bailout. And, you know, this whole BS game that goes on, clearly that there was no meeting in, I think it was Luxembourg, to talk about what was going to happen with Greece. And nobody, you know, we're not meeting at this time. They shaped their words just right to throw everybody off the track.
And that goes back to the confidence issue that you're talking about.
Right.
Everybody's so desperate to keep the confidence that they're willing to lie.
Right, which, by the way, is going to end up in no confidence, right?
Well, it's interesting. I get the joke. Having worked on this project, I'll say go back to pre-September 2008 and go back to the idea that people were talking about, you know, Dick Fuld played by Billy Crudup in the movie, Tim Geithner. this is how screwed up my head is.
Right.
But, you know, Dick Fuld went to Tim Geithner and said, please make me a bank holding company. This is back in July. Remember, by the way, right. Of course, this is what we did to Goldman and Morgan Stanley later. If you asked Tim Geithner today, why wouldn't he allow him to do it? Because he thought it would undermine confidence.
Right.
He thought it would raise a red flag. So there's a big problem, which is, you know, we all think we want transparency. We think we do, and as a journalist, by the way, that's all I'm about. And yet, there is a sense that if you tell the public too much, you can actually only make it worse.
Yeah, no, I hear you. So here's the thing, and you talk about something that leads me right into my next question for you. By the way, when does the movie come out on HBO?
May 23rd, set your DVR, 9 p.m., and then it's going to be repeated throughout the month on HBO and on demand.
And maybe on your iPad, they have that new iPad app.
HBO Go,
yeah.
If you have that, absolutely.
So question for you, and we'll kind of, I think this is really important. This is a pet peeve of mine, and it's a real problem because one of the things that you talk about is transparency, but it appears to me that there's been a dramatic change in the area of news and journalism, where it's okay to get anonymous quotes from people familiar with the situation. In the old days, I remember you had to get one or two conflicting or at least corroborating witnesses, if you will, on the subject, and then it had to be vetted, et cetera, blah 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 blah. But these days, we get this kind of, I think it's a testing of the water so that it can be pulled. So the news is being used as a propaganda machine, frankly, in some cases. Do you think that's this anonymous thing has gotten out of hand?
Complicated question, because I've relied on anonymous sources for a lot of my reporting, and I've ultimately felt comfortable with it. But I do spend an inordinate amount of time doing what you talked about in the beginning, which is that I think in a previous generation, reporters, you know, had a number of sources that were trying to corroborate each piece of information so that you weren't publishing propaganda, as you just described it. I think that actually the sort of emergence of the internet, the democratization of the internet, and the idea that anyone can say anything, and really sort of the increased competition among electronic media has actually created a bit of a conundrum around anonymous sources, because people are more and more willing to go with early stage stuff. I'll give you a great example. Just this week, we reported it, right? Microsoft bought Skype.
Oh, yeah. That was early when it came out.
Right. $8.5 billion.
Right.
Okay. And we had real sources and multiple sources to get that story in the paper. However, a blog, to their credit, I guess, earlier that day had published an anonymous piece speculating that Microsoft was going to buy Skype and said that they had an inside source, but they didn't really know and weren't really sure, but they're going to throw it out there just in case.
Right.
It's a different standard. Now, to his credit, this guy got it right. It was just as possible he could have gotten it wrong.
Right.
And that's sort of the issue.
And the reason why most people didn't believe it, by the way, when it came out from the blog, was because it's such a crap deal that it was hard to believe.
There's an element of truth there, too.
Andrew Ross Sorkin, author of Too Big to Fail, and little old me, thinks that the potential for a more permanent position on television is in the wings, but don't say anything. I think that the CNBC grooming.
I love. You know what? Let me say this out loud. I love what I do every day in print, and I love what I get to do in the morning with the folks on Squawk Box.
Yep, you do a great job. And also, he also writes for the New York Times in
the deal book, which is my baby.
Yep, absolutely. The deal book is great. Great stuff there. Watch his movie, check out his book, and I appreciate us finally getting together, my friend.
Hey, thank you so much.
Now, next up, we go back in time a little bit to April of 2008 when we had Robert Reich on. He was the 22nd Secretary of Labor for the United States. And this was episode number 52 where we had a really good discussion with him regarding a lot of the current issues that were surrounding the economy of time and a few other things. Take a listen to this.
So you have a new book. It's called Super Capitalism, just one of 11. I just finished a book, and it was like giving birth. I can't imagine 11 books. That's quite a quite an amazing, just on its own, it's amazing.
Well, if you're old enough, you can do as many books as you can imagine.
I suppose. So explain to everybody, what is super capitalism and what is the whole, thesis behind what you had written?
I define it as super competitive capitalism, in which every company, every corporation is in far more intense competition with every other one, both domestically and around the world, than we have seen perhaps ever before. I hesitated a little bit saying perhaps ever before because our data and studies don't go back much before the early part of the 19th century in terms of what kind of competition companies felt themselves under, perhaps in a local or regional markets. But there's no question that since the 1970s, because of globalization and technological improvements, more and more actors, companies, entrepreneurs can get into almost any space. And so the old barriers to entry that used to be there, consisting primarily of economies of scale, you only had three or four major companies in every industry, like the auto industry with GM, Ford, and Chrysler, because you couldn't have more than three or four companies if they were going to depend on economies of scale, high volume, standardized mass production. But those days are over. They're over because globalization and technological change have allowed almost anybody to enter, even without large-scale economies.
Mm-hmm. But at the same time, I have in front of me a letter that's dated, let's see, March 14th from my son's principal. He's in sixth grade. It says, one of the best lessons I've ever learned in life is to reward the effort, not the result. And it seems to be this epidemic that's going on, whereas kids get, and I think even George Carlin just had a skit on this, that, you know, that people just get rewarded gratuitously for being there, for kind of breathing and being on the team rather than actually, you know, performing. So how do we account for the fact that we have this, you know, is it kind of going to end with this generation? The next generation is going to be a bunch of couch potatoes, you know, that wish, hoping for trophies, or is this going to continue on for a long time?
No, I think just the opposite. I think that most people in the workforce today are working harder than their counterparts worked 20 or 30 or 40 years ago. I mean, we're seeing a workforce today in most families consisting of two wage earners. 30, 40 years ago, it was one wage earner. Most people today in the workforce are working longer hours. In fact, the average American is putting in something in the order, and I don't have the data right in front of me, about 300 or 400 hours a year more than the average European, more than the even industrious Japanese. We're also seeing that people are working under conditions where they have two or three jobs, perhaps part-time. We haven't seen this degree of intense workaholism on the part of any people in modern civilization, certainly not an advanced post-industrial country.
Well, what's the reason? Is it because of the always on? Is it because we have to, because things cost so much? Because the fact of the matter is, we're doing it just to succeed, and the eventual success is the kind of the brass ring. There's no time to relish the success.
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, part of it is related to what I said a moment ago about the changing structure of the American economy. 30, 40 years ago, when you had three or four major players in every industry, they roughly coordinated their production and their prices and their investments so that competition wasn't very intense. That meant that jobs were more secure. Many of these large companies resembled civil service bureaucracies. You worked your way up through the company over your lifetime. You stayed with the company for 40 years. Maybe you retired with a golden watch. You had a pension plan. It was a defined benefit plan, meaning you got a certain amount every month. You had a health plan. Well, those days are over. Every company is so intensely competitive with every other. They're trying to reduce costs, deliver better products. Now the entry barrier is not, in most cases, economies of scale. It's improvements, new efficiencies, new products and processes and services that are faster, cheaper, and better. This puts everybody in the company under enormous strain and stress because not only do you, as an employee, have to keep up, but if you don't, you're going to be out of a job. You can't adjust the level of your work very often. It's either you're billing clients, and billable hours are something that people now have to contend with in professional life, such as they never contended with before. If you don't put in enough billable hours, you may find yourself either without a job or substantially demoted, or even if you're a factory worker or a service worker, a production worker, you've got to put in overtime. And a lot of your salary is dependent on the number of hours worked, the amount of overtime. There's no cruise control any longer in this economy.
Right. Well, I mean, and then on the other hand, you read, and it's, again, a little bit outside of discussion, or maybe it isn't. Last week, I was reading an article. I want to say it was Wall Street Journal, but maybe it was Investor's Business Daily, about the milk company in India. There's no longer the need for the men to deliver the milk anymore. I don't know if you saw this piece. And they're still going to work every single day. They don't work. As a matter of fact, they have to go to work because if they leave work, they won't get paid. But as long as they show up, the milkman, as long as they show up to the job, sit around, play cards, read, and play games all day, they'll get paid. But, you know, it is essentially it's been, turned back to the government, and it's a job there. I mean, really what we've done here is, when you say, I guess, super capitalism, really, it's the point of just, you know, so much stress on the company and the government just, I guess, not helping, which is that, you know, that republicanism, if you will. And I mean, I guess that's what the problem has been, and the competitive nature of, our country, and the fact that for a long time, I think that we were plain lazy and just expecting that we were the best.
Well, I don't know whether in the 1950s and 60s, let's call it the old economy, not that old. I remember the economy of the 50s and 60s. Let's call it the old economy. It was a simpler economy. People did not work as hard. The products and services did not change very much. I remember my father buying a Plymouth every 5 years or 6 years. It was essentially the same under the hood every 5 or 6 years. He bought a new Plymouth because he felt he just needed to make sure that it would not go completely bust on him. Mm-hmm. He didn't expect very much from it.
Right.
If you wanted a telephone, you had to deal with Ma Bell.
Mm.
There was no competition.
Mm-hmm.
If you wanted to put your savings somewhere, you didn't have Fidelity or Merrill Lynch or all of the different kinds of money market funds. No, you basically had a bank, the local bank, like Jimmy Stewart in It's a Wonderful Life. And I'm not saying that was a bad time, and I'm not saying it was a good time. It was just a very different time. We as consumers and investors didn't do all that well, didn't have many choices. But we as workers and as citizens had a chance to relax a little bit.
Right.
That's not the case. It's just been flipped in the other direction. We now, as investors, to the extent that we are investors, and notwithstanding what's been happening on Wall Street over the last year, but generally speaking, we as investors have been doing pretty good, pretty well. And we as consumers have been doing pretty well as well, also, given the number of innovations, given that, you look at the real prices of, say, a television set. In inflation-adjusted terms, televisions have been getting cheaper and cheaper. The same thing with any kind of stereo equipment, same with vacuum cleaners, appliances. I mean, everything is getting, in real terms, adjusted for inflation, cheaper, except stuff that cannot be boiled down to the normal competitive market, and that is medical costs, food, oil prices. None of those are subjected to the normal increasingly competitive market.
Now, not to be a conspiracy seeker here, but kind of interesting that it's the things that we need to our basic living requirements, right? I mean, oil aside, obviously we need to travel for business, but put that aside for a second. The other components, the medical and the health related costs, the food. I mean, I used to say, hey, 10 years ago, the price of bread isn't the same as it is today. I mean, it's kind of like the price of bread isn't the same today as it was yesterday anymore. And, I guess a lot of that has to do with the overconsumption, right? And, you talk about super capitalism. Maybe the next title is super consumption. You know, the fact is, you remember that game Pac-Man? Remember Pac-Man?
Yeah.
I see China as this giant Pac-Man just kind of eating through the Earth's mantle, everything in its way. Yeah. It's just consuming. But where does that leave us? Seriously, what's going on? I mean, yeah, there's some speculative nature of the pricing of corn and soybean and all that. But I mean, seriously, where are we going here?
Well, here's the problem. And it's not really a problem from the standpoint of China and India, because after all, their emerging middle classes want everything that Europeans and Americans and the middle classes of America and Europe have had. But it's a problem from the standpoint of global resources, because if a billion Chinese and a billion Indians join the ranks of 300 million Europeans and 300 million Americans, using up that amount of energy, that amount of food, that amount of all the other components that go into a middle-class lifestyle, then the planet will be destroyed. There's no way we can possibly live unless we all, in advanced countries now, and I'm talking about Europe and the United States and also Japan, agree that we are going to tighten our belts a little bit, or perhaps not enjoy quite the increase in living standards that we've become accustomed to. Uh-huh. And at the same time, we invest in new technologies that will hopefully allow us to make the environment cleaner, avoid global warming, generate even more productivity from the soil in terms of food. You know, there are things that can be done. 50 years ago, 100 years ago, nobody would have expected that there could be 6 billion people on the globe, mm-hmm. And that so many of them could be living so well.
But, you know, at the same time, we talk about doing the right thing, right? That's what we're talking about, doing the right thing, saving the planet, all these wonderful things. But let's just look at what just happened the last 6 months. You know, talk about greed. I mean, you're telling me that what we have to do is tighten our belts, do the right thing, maybe not live so high on the hog. But meanwhile, you know, just a few months ago, just 6 months ago, a year ago, we have a Wall Street phenomena, which is a greed-infested banking and financial industry that has really done a tremendous number that we're seeing daily. Again, issues coming today. Wachovia came out with a real doozy, and who knows what's coming the rest of this week. I mean, we have a Fed that put, what do we have to, $400 billion of handouts at this point, and quite, you know, where are we going from here? I mean, I don't understand how this all balances. I don't understand what's going to, you know, and then the follow-up question is, what's next? Where are we, what's the next thing that's going to happen that's going to be disastrous in this current environment?
Well, you know, you're right in talking about finance. I mean, what's happened is that over the same course of 50 years, comparing the old economy to the new, finance has gone from being the handmaiden of industry. The financial markets would help arrange mergers or acquisitions or new issues of stock, to being basically industry, the plaything of Wall Street and the plaything of finance. Finance is where all the big money is, where all the big deals are, where a lot of the entrepreneurship is. Finance has become the kind of leading indicator of the economy. And it's the least controlled in the sense that we don't know what's going on there. Even the heads of big Wall Street banks don't know. And yet at the same time, ironically, we citizens are bailing out Wall Street to the tune, as you said, of hundreds of billions of dollars. The Fed has become a fourth branch of government, more powerful than the other three. We don't even, you know, the Fed can appropriate, in effect, appropriate hundreds of billions of taxpayer dollars without a hearing, without a authorization hearing, an appropriation hearing, without anybody knowing anything about it. The Fed can bring one bank down and arrange a merger or an acquisition with another bank and put up federal taxpayers' money to do that. The Fed can, and it does it now, it's doing it right now as we speak, reduce interest rates and thereby accomplish some things, but at the same time create some dangers, such as a falling dollar that makes oil and food even more expensive for our people. Mm-hmm. Can you imagine Congress arranging things so that oil prices and food prices would be heading upward? There has to be some way, it seems to me, of maybe not politicizing the Fed. I'd hate for the Fed to be subject to partisan politics, but at the same time, making it more accountable, giving people more idea about what the Fed is actually doing, why it's doing it, and what we can expect from financial markets.
Well, you know, it's interesting because it was, I don't know if you know my friend Barry Ritholtz, he had a piece on his blog today or yesterday about Volcker saying, you know, Volcker is not at all happy with Bernanke, and, you know, the big question, actually, I was talking to Barry earlier, and he said that he wanted to ask, you know, if Obama comes in, to the presidential seat, who do you believe he would replace, or if he would replace Bernanke with someone? You have an answer to that?
I don't think a new president will replace Bernanke. You don't want to replace Fed chairs unless you have to. By the way, the Fed chair is appointed for 4 years.
Mm-hmm.
So Bernanke came last year, so he would still have another couple of years
mm-hmm.
to go
right.
With a new president in any event.
Right.
You don't want to undermine the confidence of financial markets by changing the chairman of the Federal Reserve Board unless there is broad consensus that the chair has done a bad job. Now, Bernanke, I think, has done a fairly good job. His predecessor, Alan Greenspan, got us into this mess.
Well,
Greenspan, it was Greenspan's cutting interest rates down to 1% federal funds rate in 2003, and then basically poo-pooing any effort to have any federal oversight at all of what was going on. You can't make money that cheap and at the same time expect there won't be every lender in the world trying to get money out of the door into the hands of any potential borrower who can
right.
simply stand up straight.
Right.
And you have to have oversight, at least in the United States, and to the extent that you can do that around the world. That's something Greenspan just didn't care about.
Right. So, I've always asked the question, if you could borrow money at zero cost, how much do you borrow? I mean, all of it, right?
Of course, that's what happened.
On.
I mean, the money was so cheap that it went out to anybody. It created a housing bubble. We are living with the results of that housing bubble bursting. The results are also found not only in the decline of the most important assets people have, the middle class, their houses or their nest eggs, but also their pension plans. We're
mm-hmm.
seeing pension plans that are going substantially downhill because of the crisis on Wall Street, and then credit markets are completely blocked, and largely because nobody knows how much bad debt anybody else is holding, which is going to make this recession possibly much worse than otherwise.
A couple of points I want to mention. Harry Dent, who has been on my show many times and love his work, pretty radical in terms of some of his theories. Talks about 2009 being the next great depression, and it's based on demographic economics, where you look at the average person's age and how much they spend, et cetera, et cetera. You had written a couple of pieces on your blog, great blog by the way, and I'll put the links on the show notes that are, and asked the question, and then wrote about are we headed to a depression? Are we?
First of all, there's no consensus about what a depression means, unlike a recession, which is two back-to-back quarters of negative growth where the economy contracts. A depression, all we know and all we know in kind of common parlance is that depression is something very bad, and it is probably a very severe and long recession.
Mm-hmm.
Is that likely to come about? I place the probability around 20%, creeping up there. Maybe it's a little higher than 20%. Not very high, but not very comfortable. Even at that rate.
Right.
The next recession. The consensus that I have heard among Wall Street types is that the recession will end. That we are in one, but it will end the second half of this year as all of those economic stimulus checks go out. I think that's baloney.
Oh, that's crap.
Frankly,
those aren't going to do anything.
I think that these are cheerleaders. I think a lot of people on Wall Street just want to be cheerleaders. That's what their natural inclination is. They would like to have a rally. The reality is...
Come on. That was a great interview with Robert Reich. If you want to hear the whole interview, or if you want to find out other guests that have been on the podcast, by the way, you can go over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com. And right on the podcast summary page, there's a way to search for guests and stock names and different things and a whole list of names of people that will come up or episodes. Just search for the episode number in that list and you can find all that. Let's kick it back now to November of 2007, episode number 35. I kind of got off on a little bit of a rant in the beginning here. Let's hear what I had to say back then when things were starting to go off the rails with markets.
Let me kind of switch gears for a minute. Let me talk about what's going on in these markets, or really what's not. The only thing worse than running out of turkey on Thanksgiving is talk about cutting dividends on stocks, I think. There is nothing here that is to be taken lightly. It ranks up there with
yelling fire in a theater, and almost it's almost as bad as telling an investor that they can't withdraw money from their accounts. Maybe if you're a hedge fund, a mutual fund, saying, hey, you know what? You can't get your money. The recent flurry of negative news concentrating on the financial sector has many investors really running for cover, as many are very apprehensive about what else can lurk beneath the surface. Of course, that is relatively clear to most of us, isn't it? What may not be so apparent is what financial firms will do in their desperation to help defray the costs associated with their frolic through what we say is Hell's Gate, which is now better known as the mortgage business. It is extremely troubling to find that the shoes dropping are not showing any signs of abating. In fact, it seems that the number of shoes related to the problem in the financial sector can only be matched in quantity to those found in the closets of Imelda Marcos. Remember her? The truth is that the recent announcement by the Federal Home Loan Corporation, also known as Freddie Mac, who is considered a traditional conforming lender, not the subprime type, is much more significant, as the realization that the spread of the subprime problem has apparently seeped into areas that has not been anticipated by most analysts. Now, direct from the pages of Freddie Mac, I took some notes, and it says, as of the September 30th website, they had $3 billion of a cushion, this cushion of $3 billion over the mandatory target surplus that they needed. They said this is a real permanent at-risk capital that provides the first line of defense in an unlikely event of a financial catastrophe at Freddie Mac. Since shareholders are the ones providing the capital, they and not the taxpayers will be the ones to bear the losses. Shareholders expect an adequate return on their investment in exchange for putting their money out in the line. But like any other investor, they buy our stock at their own risk. Very nice. Now, according to reports by the company, Freddie Mac saw their fair value of its net assets decrease by about $8.1 billion, I believe it was, in the third quarter. They also hinted at the possibility just recently that they'll be cutting the dividend in a defensive move to protect the required level of capital surplus that they're required to have, which is imposed by regulators. A cut to their dividend would immediately help to stem the reduction of assets due to their ailing portfolio, but it's whether or not it will be significant enough is what is really the question. If we look at the 661 million shares outstanding, we look at a 50% cut in their common share dividend, it could save the company about $661 million or so. And this would bring the yield down to the current shareholders, but keep it reasonable enough for new investors. Of course, screwing the investors that are currently with them. Yet that will not offset the ancillary problem of the reluctance by many of their maybe to-be investors to buy their debt, even if the ratings are continually high. The combination of investor mistrust and the problems with corporations misguiding, or at least the perception that corporations are misguiding, along with a poor record of the rating agencies, is not going to bode well for any coming offerings, anything that comes out at all by Freddie Mac. Realize that the markets have this unique way of self-assessing. Even if the rating maintains high, the markets will self-assess and will react accordingly. The fact is that investors will require a tremendous amount more yield for risk involved in this particular position. Now, as the story is unfolding, there's been a lot of news and speculation about how is this company going to replenish some of the assets that they lost and bring in new money to provide for its continuing operations. Because remember something, when this company is lending and buying mortgages and using funds, they have to get it from somewhere. They have to develop these assets. But if we have this credit market crunch, where are they going to get this money? Well, it looks like it's going to be from the issuance of billions of dollars of preferred stock. The problem rests in the fact that while they are usually more liquid than traditional bonds, these preferred stocks have no guarantee that the company will make any repayment of the principal ever in the future. Now, obviously, I'm a big fan of preferred stocks, but I've never bought these Fannie Mae's or Freddie Mac's because I thought there was, the yield wasn't good enough and there were some questions about the underlying assets of the company itself into this mortgage fiasco. But why would anybody look to enter a position if they had all the information at hand that we know now about Freddie Mac? Who's going to jump in to buying preferred stocks at what, a 5.5% yield, what they've been yielding so far? I don't think so. Now, what happened with the analysts? I mean, the people we're supposed to be looking to, the broad base of experts that give us the advice about what to do with our money, what stocks to go to, how they're rated, what their future earnings are. Well, over the past several months, there have been 15 analysts that have covered this stock, and they have seen fit to keep this stock's ratings constant. I mean, it's amazing. According to the published reports by the S&P, the Standard & Poor's, the monthly trend has not changed since August. In other words, since August and before. There were three analysts that had a buy rating, three that were a buy hold, and nine that had a hold rating. Now, unless hold is the new code for sell, there is something slightly wrong here. They have it wrong too. Furthermore, these same analysts are estimating a 73% increase in EPS through 2008 as of the last report. Well, suffice it to say that this may be slightly aggressive at this point. Would you agree that the outlook is not bright for a swift recovery for this company? Even if the Fed looks to cut rates or even inject a tremendous amount of liquidity into the system right now, I don't really see how this company is going to be a viable investment or a beneficial investment for anyone. The real issue is what is going to be left of the domestic financial system unless a significant, and a significant is probably something none of us have ever really thought of. Probably even the people running for their offices right now have really never considered how significant this overhaul needs to be, but it needs to be significant, it needs to be sound, and it needs to be immediate. Once again, the weak dollar that we've talked about combined with excessive spending and absolutely outright pathetic oversight on the part of this administration has made our economy more vulnerable than it has been for decades. You know, this is not the same as it was in 1999 through 2002. That was a bad time. No, that was a market event that was predicated on the fact that this massive and unrelenting speculation allowed for markets to overheat. And as the adjustments made by the Fed, you looked at them more as a market event and a market adjustment rather than economically based and economically centric. Currently, there is a cancer eating away at the core of our financial system, and it is clearly rooted in greed. Once again, the derivatives, fancy packaging of financial securities, along with a heavy dose of corporate misguidance, has provided for disastrous results. And who's going to pay for it? Yeah, you, raise your hand. Yeah, me, raise my hand. Now all you're going to hear is buy and hold as the only salvation and the only saving commentary after there were so few that were willing to step out and tell us what was really going on. Way back in July, we predicted that this was not only the storm, not only the eye of the storm, this was really something that was going to be very, very significant. And all of a sudden, August, it just turned around and it was like nothing. Now investors are left to lick their wounds and hope that the economy is able to sustain this direct blow. Remember, if we compare technology, the technology sector, and think about this as the brains of the overall body, right? We can say that the financial sector is the heart that pumps all of the necessary components throughout the system, allowing for it to work. The fact of the matter is that there was many things done by individuals, by speculators, and by regulators who have to share in the blame of what's going on right now. But rest assured, we all need to shore up our positions. Watch your credit. Watch your accounts. Make sure to keep a close eye. And if you can't do it, get someone else to do it for you to help you with it. You know, you shouldn't be saddled with the full responsibility. If you have to work, you have a family, or whatever it is, hire somebody qualified to do so.
Yeah, those are the days when there was a lot to talk about when it comes to markets and watching where you walk, watching what you invest in, looking for what was going to be the next, you know, consequence of some of the bad actors that were out there. But then we switched gears. Back in July 2008, we had on someone who I thought was just a great guest, John Perkins, who wrote the book Confessions of an Economic Hitman. This was episode number 64, my interview with John Perkins, the author.
As promised, we are here with John Perkins, bestselling author of many books, particularly many of you may know him from his book called The Confessions of an Economic Hitman, and his latest book, which is out recently, is all about the American Empire. And matter of fact, it's on the bestseller list called The Secret History of the American Empire.
And I've been working on getting this interview for a long time, and I'm pretty excited because I'm just amazed about this story. So thanks for joining us, John Perkins.
It's my pleasure to be with you, Andrew. Thanks for having me on your show.
Let me, you know, your first book, for those people that don't really, maybe haven't had the opportunity to read it or listen to it, Confessions of an Economic Hitman, just a riveting tale that it talked about jackals and EMFs and a variety. Give me the lowdown on what's a jackal? What's an EMF? What do we need to know about, you know, what you've been involved with?
Well, I think the short version is to say that during the last quarter century or so, we've managed to create the world's first truly global empire, and one that's been created primarily without the military, primarily through economics, through economic hitmen like me, like what I was. And we work in many different ways, but perhaps the most common, is that we'll pick a third world country that has resources our corporations covet, like oil, and then arrange a huge loan to that country from the World Bank or one of its sisters. But the money never actually goes to the country. Instead, it goes to one of our corporations to build infrastructure projects in that country, things like power plants and industrial parks and highways that benefit a few rich people in the country, as well as our own corporations, but don't help the majority of the people who are too poor to buy much electricity or own cars to drive on the highways, don't have the skills to get jobs in industrial parks. However, they're left holding a very large debt, such a large debt that they can't possibly repay it. So at some point, we economic hitmen go back and say, listen, you can't pay your debts. Give us a pound of flesh. Sell your oil real cheap to our oil companies or vote with us on a critical United Nations vote or send troops in support of ours to Iraq or someplace else in the world. And in that way, we've really formed this empire. Now, when we fail, which isn't too often, but I describe in my books how I failed in Ecuador with Jaime Roldós, the president of Ecuador. I wasn't able to bring him around to get him to accept these terrible conditions for his country, nor with Omar Torrijos of Panama. And on those occasions, the jackals step in. These are people who either overthrow governments or assassinate their leaders. In the case of both Jaime Roldós of Ecuador and Omar Torrijos of Panama, because I was unable to corrupt them, they were assassinated by CIA-supported operatives. And in the few occasions when both the economic hitmen and the jackals fail, then and only then do we send in the military. That's what happened in Iraq.
So it's kind of like a behind-the-scenes process, very hush-hush, as you're describing, a kind of a friendly, listen, we really want you to do this, and it builds, it escalates into a very significant situation that could end up in a very, you know, in a personal injury of sorts, as you've mentioned about the several aircraft, mysterious aircraft incidents with involving not only senators, I believe, but other political heads of state from various countries. And so this is what went on. Is it still going on?
Oh, absolutely. Probably in some respects worse now than ever. Although I think in recent times we've discovered that these tactics aren't working quite as well. For example, in Latin America, 9 countries in the last democratic elections have voted in presidents that are standing up to us. And this is a huge revolution. These are democratically elected presidents. There's been no violence. These are in 9 countries that up until very recently, during all of my lifetime, were run by brutal dictators under Washington's thumb. And just in the recent elections, democratic ones, the candidates have been elected who said no to all of this and are standing up to us. And I guarantee you that, and I've talked to a number of these presidents, I talk about this in Secret History, that every one of these presidents has been approached by someone who has my old job and says to them, well, congratulations, Mr. President, or in the case of Chile and Argentina, Ms. President. And now I just want to remind you that I can make you and your family very rich if you play our game. But if you decide to keep your campaign promises and stand up to our corporations and not allow them to exploit you anymore, then, well, just remember what happened to Allende of Chile, who was overthrown and died at the CIA operation. Arbenz of Guatemala, or Mossadegh of Iran, or Lumumba of the Congo, or Roldós of Ecuador, or Diem of Vietnam, or Torrijos or Noriega of Panama. And every one of these presidents knows that the CIA took out all these other people, either overthrew them or murdered them. And so you know, it's a very, very difficult situation. So every one of these presidents now is confronting this. It's going on today very, very strongly. And yet now, because in Latin America you've got nine countries like this, they're taking a lot of comfort in the fact that there's quite an alliance down there. It would be very, very difficult for us to have coups or assassinate all nine of these presidents.
Yeah, and I think that the one that you talk about now is Chavez, obviously standing up to us. But you know, it's interesting. Let me just back up because I think what was different in your latest book and the detail that you go into there about how when you look at some of these things that we hear about here, the reality is that many of them are just political smoke screens to make us really turn against the various and sundry characters down in maybe South America or possibly the Middle East or wherever else it is around the world, so that, you know, we can have American support behind the fact that they're some kind of terrible drug dealer, when in fact, you know, they're just trying to do their thing and not cooperate with us is the problem, and we're spinning this whole thing. Do I have that straight?
Absolutely. You know, yeah, one reason I wrote The Secret History of the American Empire as a follow-up to Confessions of an Economic Hitman was I wanted to bring things up to date, and I wanted to talk about other economic hitmen who've stepped forward since I wrote that book and their experiences and what some of these presidents are saying. I spent a lot of time in Latin America in the last few years. In fact, I just came back from there a couple of months ago. The misinformation that the American people get is extremely disturbing to me. These nine presidents in Latin America who represent, incidentally, more than 80% of the population of South America, there's no question, if you go to their countries, if you talk to people who've observed the elections, that they're democratically elected. There may have been a few irregularities in the process, but they are democratically elected. We may not like them up here. Our corporations may not like them. I have a lot of problems myself personally with Chavez and his rhetoric. But the fact of the matter is they are democratically elected time and time again. And every one of them is, in fact, elected by a larger percentage of their population than our presidents here in the United States are elected by. Mm-hmm. And yet you hear our mainstream press constantly referring to them as, you know, Morales, the dictator of Bolivia, or Chavez, the dictator of Venezuela. They are not dictators. We may not like their policies. Some of us may not. But they are democratically elected. And if we profess to be the world's defender of democracy, we need to defend that process. And it's extremely disturbing how strongly influenced the media is in this country, the mainstream media, by the big corporations. And the big corporations don't like these presidents because they're threatening to tax them more. They're saying things like the profits from Ecuador's petroleum ought to be used to help Ecuador's people, poor people, and the profits from Bolivia's gas ought to be used to help Bolivia's poor people, not just big international foreign corporations.
That makes sense. But you know, just as a point of reference, you talk about the media, and this is a much smaller item here, but again, this is from the Whatever It's Worth department in a much more localized situation, but I had 24 points that I was, and again, who am I, but 24 points that I really researched and found in February that was going to be a big concern on the U.S. in terms of, you know, housing and credit and just all sorts of problems that were going to be escalating after a number of meetings and research I did. I sent it to my local newspaper down here in South Florida, and 24 points, and pressed them on it, saying, you know what, instead of looking backwards at all this, why don't you look forwards at it? They didn't do anything with any of it. That's first. The second thing is, I gave a very large weekly newspaper several opportunities on a variety of different matters. But because I was going against the market, I was negative on things, they wouldn't print any of it. One story I gave them out of that was a positive spin, and they printed it immediately.
Yeah, well, all you got to do is look at who their advertisers are.
Right.
You know,
right.
And, you know, it's Confessions of an Economic Hitman, Andrew, was on the New York Times bestseller list for over 70 weeks, about a year and a half. And it was never reviewed by the New York Times because it challenges some of these companies that are their main advertisers, and, mm-hmm. and they have a policy of not doing that. And,
right.
it's very sad that we think of ourselves as having a free press, but we don't. But I think the good news out of all of this is that, in fact, this global empire, if there's an emperor, if we want to identify the equivalent of an emperor, it's obviously not our president. An emperor is not elected, doesn't serve a limited term, and doesn't report to anybody. Our presidents don't fall into that category. But we do have a group of people that do, and that's the people who run our biggest corporations. This is not a conspiracy theory. These people do not have to get together and conspire to do these things. They do illegal actions. What they do is legal, but it should be changed. These people are all driven by one single goal, and that is to maximize profits regardless of the environmental and social costs.
Mm-hmm.
And in obtaining that goal, they've created a very, very dangerous world, a world that I have a nine-month-old grandson. I don't really want my grandson to grow up in that world. But the good news is that these corporations are all very vulnerable to us, the consumer. They cannot exist unless we consume their goods and services. And in the past, we've had a tremendous influence over them. We've gotten them to clean up terribly polluted rivers in the United States, get rid of aerosol cans that were polluting, that were destroying the ozone layer, get trans fats out of their foods and antibiotics out of chickens and cows, and open their doors wider to African Americans and other minorities and to women. And so now we just really need to ratchet this up a notch and say, listen, let's change that goal. And instead of a goal that says maximize profits regardless of social and environmental costs, go ahead and maximize profits, but with only within the context of creating a sustainable, just, and peaceful world
mm-hmm.
for everybody everywhere. Because we must recognize, I must recognize, that my grandson cannot have a sustainable, peaceful, and just world unless every child growing up in Africa, Asia, Latin America, and the Middle East has that same expectation and it's fulfilled. We're a very, very small world today.
Yeah. And to one of the things that, as I'm reading this, I mean, it's a very, and when I say sensational, I don't mean that in a negative way. I mean that like, wow, you know, it's an amazing story. And one thing, though, actually, it's two things that to kind of, it's been gnawing at me. I hope you can answer this for me. First of all, I guess the whole theory that these jackals, these are highly trained and highly skilled and highly behind the scenes cloak and dagger types. Is that right?
That's correct, yes.
Okay. And these guys can, you know, make things happen and make it look a different way. And my question is, I don't know exactly how to say this, but why are you still alive?
Oh, well, you know, and I do actually address that in Secret History. When I got out of this profession as an economic hitman in the early 80s, I started to write the book, which became Confessions of an Economic Hitman, and I went out and contacted other economic hitmen and jackals. And at that point, I was then contacted and threatened. My life was threatened, and I was offered big bribes, legal bribes, as, you know, being a retainer for a consulting firm but not having to do anything, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
I had a very young daughter who's now 26. Kate just gave me a grandson.
Mm.
And I was scared. I mean, I'd seen what jackals could do. So I took the threats very seriously, and I took the bribes. And I put a lot of the money from the bribes toward nonprofit organizations. You can see them on the website, dreamchange.org, pachamama.org. They were working to help the people that I'd screwed in the past. So it's kind of assuaged my guilt. But I did not write the books. And then 9/11 happened, and I went up to Ground Zero shortly afterwards, and as I stood there looking down into that smoldering pit, I knew I had to write this book. I knew that the American people did not have a good understanding of why there's so much resentment in the world. This is in no way meant to condone the mass murder that happened.
I got to tell you something. It was a great interview. I cut it off right there. We have a few more to get to, but I really encourage you. We're going to put all of the links to the various podcasts and the episodes so you can listen to those right on the show notes for this episode, episode number 500 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. So make sure that you are going over to the site and you can click and listen to the whole entire episode and see what's going on there. You know, you may have heard of a site called Zero Hedge. It's a pretty, you know, they uncover a lot of very interesting and very, in some ways, conspiracies type of underhanded works and does a lot of work and really trying to, it looks like, stir the pot. Well, back in the day, we had on the namesake, the founder, who calls himself Tyler Durden. It's not his real name, but we did have him on back in November of 2009 in episode 136. Listen to this.
Goes under that, well, let's say under that name, as we're trying to keep a lower profile because some of the things that he talks about is pretty intense and, you know, some of the things he needs to do is maintain his anonymity. But he writes for the Zero Hedge, which is a site that we love. It uncovers a lot of really interesting areas, in whether it comes to the stock market or when it comes to various brokerages. So I welcome my friend Tyler. How are you, buddy?
I'm good. Thank you.
So let's start talking about this. There's so much to talk about. I mean, we haven't talked in a little while, but now the I talked about this earlier in the podcast. Geithner is under the gun asking, I don't know if it's a little bit of grandstanding by some of these congressmen, but, you know, they're asking for his resignation. Do you think that has any, I mean, seriously, does it have any real merit?
Well, you know, I think it's more of a political question than a economic or financial one.
Right.
Obviously, it makes for good theater. That's a given. We have seen politics get involved kind of at the intersection of Wall Street and Main Street in the past. I think the most recent example, of course, was the AIG situation and the whole bonus fiasco, where, you know, there was a whole lot of, you know, ado about pretty much nothing at the end of the day. In many ways, a lot of the cynics out there believe that this is simply a way to kind of blow off some of the pent up anger at people at the administration who, especially in, following the Siktarp report on AIG, which essentially put the entire blame on Tim Geithner, that, in other words, that is a way to get the public anger out there in the public, you know, kind of more of a psychological issue than anything. The real question, of course, vis-a-vis Tim Geithner's political career, in my opinion, will have to do with just the overall performance of the economy over the next, you know, 6 to 12 months heading into the midterm elections. Some of the other cynics in the economic domain think that basically Mr. Geithner will be the scapegoat in the situation where there isn't any dramatic improvement in employment, or rather unemployment, and that if push came to shove, that he would be basically first in the sacrificial altar, if you will.
Mm. Well, somebody's got to be put up there, it seems, because we can't let the real people who are damaging things go down, you know? You know, it's interesting. I think, you know, you've been pretty negative on the economy. I don't think I've ever really seen anything positive, per se. But give me this. Would you agree that there was a little time there that things were getting a little bit better from where they were? And what I mean is, I'm not trying to be, you know, politically correct or all for the media, but saying that, you know, things were pretty much at a standstill, at a stop, the old falling off the cliff discussion. And then things at least did, I hate using the word stabilize, but they did at least stop falling for a little while there. Would you agree with that?
Oh, no, I totally agree with that. My personal opinion on the economy, frankly, it's not that it's, you know, negative above all else. You have to put things into perspective, which is that over the past year, we have seen the most unprecedented, you know, deposition of liquidity, courtesy of the Federal Reserve, and of stimulus payments. In other words, both a monetary and a fiscal stimulus in the economy, which do not have parallels with anything all the way back to the Great Depression. So if you put all those together, it is inevitable that you will see a rebound in the economy one way or another. The real question, and the question that, for example, Jan Hatzius of Goldman Sachs, their head economist, has been posing more and more recently, is just how sustainable is this so-called one-time benefit that we have already, in many estimations, seen the peak of. In other words, yes, we have seen a pickup in GDP. You know, preliminary estimates for Q3 GDP are at 3.5%. People believe that at further readings and as more information emerges, that this number actually will be trimmed down. However, the biggest question mark is what happens, not so much in Q4, which probably will not be a big disappointment, but how will 2010 proceed? And, you know, now more so than ever, the biggest wild card is becoming China. And what will really happen to China, which in many ways is almost an identical situation with America, courtesy of both the renminbi peg as well as their comparable liquidity and fiscal stimulus that they're experiencing on a record basis.
I mean, do you think that China could be, you know, there's a lot of talk about China manipulating the dollar, the yuan, the renminbi, but do you think it's possible that China could be part of the process of pushing down the dollar? I mean, that's good for them overall, since they're pegged, of course. Do you think that's something that is being done, the currency moves that we're seeing? I mean, and almost on a daily basis, the really ridiculous moves on currency, clearly that's affecting markets, which is odd in itself. But do you think that it's being done because of that, so you don't have to say that you're manipulating your own currency?
Well, if you boil it down to the lowest common denominator, basically what happens is because of the peg, a weaker dollar, as you pointed out, benefits China. That's, you know, not debatable. Many people have even said that China hasn't been adopting mercantilist policies. You know, we'll not necessarily go into that debate. But, you know, simplistically, and the reason why a lot of Chinese competitors in Asia and a lot of the other exporting countries are very unhappy about this is because, obviously, a weak renminbi has a huge benefit to the Chinese export economy. And while America, for example, doesn't benefit as much from a weak currency, courtesy of the fact that our manufacturing base has been decimated.
Because we don't sell anything anymore, is that why?
That's exactly correct. However, who does benefit is China. Right. And because of the peg, because of the almost parallel response to the crisis between America and China, one of the recurring themes that I have pointed out on Zero Hedge has been the fact that in many ways, courtesy of this you know, being jointed at the hip, as I put it, between China and the U.S., the two countries almost have the same monetary and fiscal goals. And, you know, the question is whether or not this, you know, duopoly of China and America can basically continue this undecoupling phase, whereas everybody, you know, a year ago, 2 years ago was harping on the decoupling. Now it's essentially completely the opposite. And in many ways, either China is, you know, the 51st state of the U.S. or, you know, we are province X of China.
Well, actually, if I may interrupt for a second, if you think about it just for a moment, it's kind of interesting because if you put China and you put the U.S., and you can add some of the other countries like Brazil and all, but let's talk about China. If you put China and the U.S. next to each other and you say, okay, who's going to benefit from the lower dollar and, you know, that concept, the truth is that China is totally benefiting. So they're kind of, if in fact they are doing it in a way like we're doing it, if they've adopted the weak dollar, even though of course from everybody out there the strong dollar policy is really in the best interest. I mean, I can't stand this discussion. You know, the strong dollar policy is in the best interest of America, but yet at the same time, you know, quantitative easing and all the stimulus, et cetera, that goes on, and the money that's being spent is obviously, you know, they know it's weakening the dollar. But
sure.
China,
sure.
In the end, is the benefactor of all of this because really they are the ones that are exporting and we're buying their price. So it's a double whammy for us.
No, you're absolutely correct. I would also add that a weak dollar for the U.S. is actually, you know, an additional benefit because it obviously, looking at the correlation between the stock market and the dollar, which has, if you were to read, I believe, Mr. Rosenberg, David Rosenberg, had a very good letter, I believe 2 days ago, so probably the 18th of November, in which he discussed that while historically the correlation between the dollar and the market is effectively nil, lately it has gone up all the way to 0.98, which is just you know, a ludicrous combination.
It's ridiculous. You know what I watched today? The whole week I was watching, I should say, the tick, you know, the tick measurement of let's just call it the buying pressure, selling pressure, essentially the advanced decline. Yeah. And I was watching the dollar index next to it. It was scarily similar.
Correct. So, and you know, you're absolutely right. That's more the you know, the actual trading level. But from a macro perspective, the U.S. benefits, and not so much the U.S., but really the top 5-10 percentile of the U.S. population, which actually does have a lot of their liquid net worth invested in stocks. And another thing to keep in mind is that those 10% of the population who are being targeted to, you know, basically generate a lot of capital gains courtesy of a dropping dollar, they are the ones that spend roughly 45% of all consumer dollars. And again, as we all know, consumers make up 75% of the GDP. Not only that, but they also make up roughly 60%, I believe, of federal taxable revenue. So, on one hand, the Obama administration is promoting a weak dollar courtesy, even, you know, contrary to what Mr. Geithner and Mr. Bernanke would say on a day-to-day basis, which, of course, does benefit China and does benefit its cheap exporting base, which in turn helps Walmart and the lower class in America to buy, you know, cheap stuff at Walmart and other discount stores. but it also benefits the top crust of U.S. society, those people who do have a lot of their assets tied up in with the stock market. So on whose back is really all of this, you know, occurring? Because obviously for every winner, you must have a loser, and
we're the loser.
Yeah, well, so that was episode number, what do we have, 136 of a discussion with Tyler Durden from Zero Hedge. And it wouldn't be complete, and I don't think we would have a complete kind of look back in history if we didn't bring up Jack Schwager, author of the series Market Wizards. Back in May of 2011 on episode number 214, we had a really good discussion.
One is look at people who are doing it right, and the other is look at people who are doing it wrong and don't, you know, do something different. But probably the first one is a more direct approach. And the thing about, of course, trading is that it is so individualistic. It doesn't mean that you try to copy what somebody else is doing, but you try to learn some of the basic principles, because there are certain universal principles that are true no matter how you approach the question of trading and investing.
Right. And, you know, so let's just go back for a second. And your first book, let's go back further. The first interview you did for your first book was what year?
I think I did that book in 88, I think is when I actually was doing the interviews. I think the book came out in 89.
And was that the days of, like, who were the names back then? There was Elaine Garisella, right?
No. Actually, the people that I was interviewing were people at the time or early on, but became sort of the famous, many of the famous hedge fund managers. So people like Paul Tudor Jones and Bruce Kovner and lesser known names, but people who were equally, if not more, as successful, such as Michael Marcus and Ed Sakota and others. So they were, I guess, in today's semantics, would be considered, most of them were the type of traders that would be considered global macro type traders.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's interesting because the hedge funds of today, one of the big differences you have is that the hedge funds today, you have a lot, first of all, there's a lot more classifications, first of all, right? But also back then, wasn't it, you know, your kind of old-fashioned way of making, well, good or bad, but the old-fashioned way of making money, buying the right stocks and your thing. Now it's kind of like, you know, I went out and I bought these derivatives that I bet on the housing crash, and I'm doing this, and I'm actually looking at making an arbitrage on shorting Japan but going long China, and at the same time, you know, moving into a cross currency. It's a whole different thing, right?
Well, yeah, but in a sense, if you touch one, like arbitrage is a good word that you threw in there. The difference is, I mean, originally most of the hedge funds were, well, very originally, the very original hedge funds, sort of along the Jones model, which was a long short type model. It was mostly net long, but longs and shorts to reduce the risk, and picking the things that you thought would go up, picking the stocks you thought were better and selling the stocks you thought were weaker. Mm-hmm. And that's called the classic Jones model. That was the very first real hedge fund back in 49, and others followed that model. And then there was a second, and that kind of faded a bit. Those type of funds receded a bit, which nowadays, by the way, they're called equity hedge funds. In the 70s, when the stock market became very difficult and people lost money, including Jones himself. And then there was like a renaissance of hedge funds sort of along the lines of Soros and people that I, Steinhardt and others. Again, a lot of people that I interviewed, although I didn't interview Soros. And those were the types of funds that were making the calls of, this currency is going to go up or this commodity is going down. It was that type of trading. It was directional global type trading.
Right.
And they became the dominant hedge funds of the time. And then as the hedge funds became more institutionalized in the 90s and 2000s, there were a lot more strategies became much more prevalent, and you had all sorts of arbitrages, like you had merger arbitrage and statistical arbitrage and convertible bond arbitrage. Mm-hmm. Like suddenly, convertible bond arbitrage didn't really exist. I don't think it even existed before the 1990s, although there were some guys who were doing it before then. But they became like major types of allocation strategies. So that was the big difference. You had these very very narrowly defined specific strategies like convertible arbitrage, which became a type of strategy.
Right.
And now you have this whole range of strategies, including the traditional ones, which we talked about, just talked about, which was the equity hedge, which is now the largest component of hedge funds, and global macro, which was much bigger when I was in Market Wizards and New Market Wizards, now is more, it's still an important strategy, but it's a much smaller part of the pie than it was then.
Well, one of the problems is with global macro, it, as the name would initially suggest, is there was an ability to look at the different components of the world and maybe look at the macro elements, you know, look at the economics, look at the, you know, look, for example, I mean, one of the first people I think I recall ever talking about this whole issue about globalization in Asia was Jim Rogers. I think that was one of the first, right? I remember.
And Jim was one of the people I interviewed in my original book, so he's a good example.
Yeah, so I remember that very distinctly. At the time, it was very fuzzy. What is he talking about, right? You know, and then it kind of became very clear on how the whole emergence of the emerging markets and very simply would just have to eat and be clothed, and that itself is going to create an enormous amount of opportunity. And then, of course, with the movement to development of the countries. Now, at that time, though, the difference, as I see it, was that you could actually go and you could see the very distinct differences country by country in the economics and the opportunity. And fast forward from that point till now, we've become very homogenized in terms of the economics, where we're seeing almost a, I don't know, you know, if it's up over here, it's up over there. If it's down over here, it's down over there.
Yeah, you're quite right. I mean, that's one of the things that have happened over time is, yeah, the world has gotten much more globalized, and a consequence of that is that investments have become much more correlated, and even more so in recent years, where you've had periods of time where just everything goes in one direction. You know, it's sort of like you tell me what direction one market went, and I could tell you what direction every market went
right.
that day.
Right.
And it wasn't always that way. There was a time where you could be long metals and short grains, and long a currency one way or the other, and there was no implication. But now it's gotten into the cliche of risk on, risk off, and it's all, everything seems to kind of go up or down together. To a great extent, and I think that's become much more prevalent in recent years, and it's probably a consequence of globalization, not only in its general framework, because the world is much more interconnected, but also because I think investments are sort of institutionalized to a greater extent.
Oh, yeah.
And everybody does the same thing. So,
well, one of the problems we have also is the advent of computers, and this is really a concern of mine, because I think that, and this is probably something that you talk about, there's got to be a high degree of frustration with you answer the question. Is there a high degree of frustration with many of the traditional players out there that are frustrated because they know there is the algorithms that are running on a constant basis that are looking for a zig one way and they'll zag you the other way, and that are so incredibly program that you look at a 100-day moving average or 50-day moving average, and you have to react to that because you know the machines will.
Well, it's not so much the moving averages, because those are the old trend following
right,
models.
Just an example.
And that's been there for a long time. What's different in recent years is a lot of money trading on really micro moves, and I guess the closest traditional hedge fund strategy to it is basically statistical arbitrage, but this is kind of statistical arbitrage in a more intense and
on steroids
on steroids in a minute way. So basically, the programs are kind of figuring out bids and asks based on a lot of inputs on everything, you know, sort of. It's like you took the old market maker, you see the floor used to kind of do this and make a meal, provide a bid, provide an offer, and kind of have a bit of ask spread and make the market that way, and kind of make human decisions along the way. Now it's done instantaneously, and it's done by in very large size by all these computer programs. So, that's caused a change, certainly. One thing is, of course, they're pulling money out of the markets, but again, market makers are pulling money out of the markets as well. I don't know what the relative size between the two are. And but it also does provide, well, it kind of, it provides liquidity most times. But I guess as the flash crash shows, it can
yeah, but before they were there, there's plenty of liquidity. So that whole argument, I think, is really bogus. I got to be honest with you. I just think the whole argument of these guys providing liquidity is the only leg they can stand on for just milking. You know, I'd rather them to stay on the sidelines and let's pay a tax to them and be done with it. You know, just if you know.
Well,
but the other thing is, though, you know what? If you were to actually put a zero bid ask, in other words, zero spread for any algorithmic traders and all that, they would stop doing what they're doing because then they'll have risk.
Well, no, they're basically I think the way to think of it is it's just it's a computerization of market making is what it really is. I mean, that's what's really going on. And it does provide, when I say liquidity, what I mean is, of course, there's more trading, but that's not so much the point. The point is the bid-ask spreads are narrower, particularly on things that are less. You know, if you're trading some options on stocks, and particularly, those things would be, they're still wide in many cases, but they would be even wider. If this, you know, one of the things that, one reason why you can do, why you can go in and buy or sell an option on individual stocks is because those programs are there making a market, you know. Right. So otherwise, you could do it, but the spreads would be really, really wide.
I hear you. Yeah.
So there is an advantage there. I don't, you know, it changes the way markets work some way, but markets are always changing anyway.
Right.
And one of the things about really good traders is they adapt. You know, I'll give you a good example here. In fact, this is, as I mentioned to you right before we got on the air here, that I'm working on another Market Wizards book, and like I said, I'm not going to mention names at this point, but there's one trader that I interviewed, interesting in many ways. One because he breaks all the rules and is kind of totally different than anybody ever saw. But he's also been very consistent. Like you know, since he started out 15 years ago, he's been making six figures consistently. You know, for a prop firm, always making money, and he trades in a very unconventional way. He's very much trading against. He really, I'll give you an example. I mean, the type of trading he does, if you remember when cotton was making its high of the move, he was in there selling on the last 2 days of the high, I mean, into the straight vertical uptrend. That's the type of trading he'll do. So it's very, very, it's very atypical, and it's not the type of thing I would recommend for hardly anybody because it's very difficult to get away with that.
No kidding.
But he makes it work because he's got some, so he's got some innate sense. But the thing is, one of the things he also does is when he goes against the trend because he thinks it's getting way overdone, he'll be trading in and out of position day in, day out. And he's constantly making money because he may be short, the market comes down, he buys some back, then it goes up again, he sells it back again. So even though he's, you know, I've been told by people who work with him and know him and that I know well, that you know, he can make money. He's on the wrong side of the trend. He's still making money just because of his in and out trading is so good. But he was telling me, like, one of the things was he had a problem was over in recent years, especially beginning around the say 2003, well, you know, later 2004, 2005, hedge funds were becoming such a big influence, and their trading was different than the trading he had been used to all those years because markets would bounce around more. But now hedge funds kind of took a position, they kind of stayed with it, and you wouldn't get that much intraday volatility. So the market would be going up, it'd be going up the whole day, and there wasn't as much back and forth movement that gave him this opportunity. So he adjusted. He would wait longer before he put on a position because he knew he'd have less opportunity to trade around the position. So he modified his approach for the changing reality of the market.
Right.
And that is kind of a good example. Even though what he does is not something that would work for almost anyone else.
Right.
But what does that illustrate? It illustrates he has the flexibility to change his approach for the changing market.
Right.
And that flexibility is, in fact, flexibility is why I list items.
Moving right along, we have to give some props to Mark Faber. You know, the gloom, doom, and report that he puts out, always looking at some of the things around the world that are ready to implode. And we had him on. He is quite the guest to have on. Back in October of 2012, Mark Faber and I spoke. It was episode number 283. Again, all these available over on The Disciplined Investor under the show notes for episode 500. But take a listen to this discussion we had.
Let's get to our first guest, why don't we? And we're on the phone with Mark Faber from the Gloom, Doom, and Boom Report. And I want to talk to him about a lot of things that he has been discussing lately. and talk about the economies around the world and some of the things that he's seeing. Mark, how are you?
Very well, thank you. And yourself?
I'm doing well, thanks. Listen, there is a lot of headwinds that are going on around the world. A lot of people are scratching their heads saying, yeah, but the markets keep on kind of doing very nicely. And what's your thoughts on this?
Well, it depends, because some markets have performed fantastically well, like Thailand is up from the 2009 lows by 257%. The Philippines, almost the same. And then you had 4 months ago, markets like Portugal, Spain, Italy, France, Greece, that were right at the 2009 lows or even lower. So it's been selective. And the U.S. Over the last 18 months, admittedly, has just about outperformed anything else.
Mm-hmm. And is a lot of this due to just value plays or people are saying finally, okay, there's a backstop? Because, you know, the ECB came out with some very big language, but from my take, they haven't really spent dollar one per se yet, right?
Well, basically, all central banks have increased their balance sheet. In other words, they have monetized government debt and other securities. And they have pushed interest rates to essentially record lows. And as you know, in the U.S., interest rates in real terms, inflation adjusted, are negative. So this is a fundamental factor that we have to consider. If interest rates are negative, inflation adjusted, then cash is endangered species. And that pushes then people into all kinds of assets, from paintings to collectibles to real estate to equities and bonds and commodities and precious metals.
Now, you've been around a long time, and one of the things that I've noticed over the last, we'll say, 4 or 5 years is that central banks' focus seem to be much more on markets than they are on the economy. The old days was the whole economy, right?
They would like to boost economic activity, but in order to do that, and they've done that for quite some time, certainly in the U.S., they target asset markets. In other words, after 2000, when the NASDAQ broke down, the Fed was actually actively recommending another bubble, supported by the new Keynesian Alan Krugman and Paul McCulley of PIMCO, that said a housing bubble would be at this stage very helpful. Well, we know now how helpful it's been. It's been
right.
The worst 10 years in American economic history in terms of personal income growth. And we had essentially a stock market that moved sideways, and we had a lot of people losing it, essentially their homes. And this is, for many families, not very pleasant if they have children that go to school in the neighborhoods of their houses.
Mm. So where is the, if you can classify where the worst markets in terms of economies and maybe markets themselves are, and where the biggest problems are, and then the best economies and the best markets, what's your pick? And that could be a wide range. That could be from real estate, gold, or, you know, whatever you want to do, or regionally.
Well, basically, very clearly, we have big structural problems in countries like Spain, Italy, Greece, Portugal, in the sense that they're not particularly competitive, and that they have very high unemployment and a huge debt burden. So these problems simply don't go away overnight. And also, we have a problem in Europe in the sense that we have really an entitlement society. And like in the U.S., we will have the problem of unfunded liabilities coming due, plus the demographics of Europe are not particularly favorable. So there are structural problems, and I think if I look forward for the next 10, 20 years, the standards of living for the median household in the U.S. and in Europe will not increase. In fact, I think it will go down. So that is essentially an outlook for these two large economies, Europe and the U.S., that is not particularly favorable. Doesn't mean that there will won't be any opportunities to make money in these countries.
Right.
I'm just saying economically they're not particularly favorable. And the more favorable economies are, in my opinion, in Asia, where you have a young population. I mean, you said you were in Cambodia. The country, whether the world is in recession or not, will continue to grow from a very low level, but it will grow and it will develop, and eventually it will become like Thailand or even having a higher standard of living than Thailand, possibly. Who knows? The same will apply to Myanmar and to Laos and so forth. And so we have still economic development in some regions of the world. But in terms of investments, I don't think that asset prices are very cheap. We had this money printing going on, and investors have largely discounted the money printing by pushing up asset prices. In other words, in the U.S., the stock market is up more than 100% from the 2009 lows. And precisely a year ago, on October 4th, the S&P was at 1,074, and we are now at 1,440. So we had essentially short-term and long-term a huge bull market, and stocks are no longer very cheap in an environment of a global economy that is, without any doubt, slowing down very rapidly. And in some cases, we are technically already in recession. Say in Asia, we are at the high level of economic activity, but we may be below the peak of 6 to 9 months ago.
Yeah. So one of the things about when I look at the United States and you talk about Europe and you talk a lot about the demographics and many of the factors that are involved with a growing economy, like you say, would be the opposite of a young economy. But then you have to look at Japan. And Japan, is Japan the roadmap for the U.S. and for Europe, and particularly Europe, U.S., because we seem to be following their entire lead of how they try to reinflate their economy and reinflate things, but it just never worked.
Well, they didn't inflate sufficiently. That's why the yen has been such a strong currency. Had they expanded the Bank of Japan's balance sheet to the same extent like the ECB expanded its balance sheet, or the Fed, I suppose the Japanese yen would be weaker, and we would have another set of problems in Japan, but we would have more inflation. But it would not help Japan, because if the yen weakens and interest rates begin to rise, then the government has a problem with the interest payments on its government debt, which is about 200% of GDP.
So when you look at the situation in terms of money printing and the amount that has been done, and at the same time in the U.S. we're getting the quote-unquote official numbers that show no inflation, how is that all possible?
Yeah, well, I mean, you say the official numbers. The official numbers, of course, do not reflect the true cost of living increases of the typical family. Maybe Mr. Bernanke doesn't eat any food, and maybe he doesn't need any energy. But most households I know in the world, they need energy and they need food. So these two prices are up, of course, substantially over the last couple of years. Insurance premiums are up substantially. Health care costs are up substantially. Just as an example, taxi fares in New York, they just went up 17%. And the tunnel fees from New Jersey to New York earlier this year went up 50%. So you have a lot of price increases that may not show up in the consumer price index. In addition, they massage the way they calculate the indices. As an example, nationwide in America, rents are now up, residential rents up 9% year on year. But it doesn't show up in the CPI. But now you have to consider the people that just lost their homes. They have no access to credit. They can't buy a house anymore. They have to go and rent. And now their rents are up 15% in San Francisco and 9% nationwide.
But I guess with all this as a backdrop, we do have to admit that in the U.S., the balance sheets are better for companies. Banks are, you know, who knows, because of their lack of transparency. But, you know, at least they're better than they were back in 2008, sure. 2009, right?
I didn't say anything different.
No, I'm just stating a point. That was all. So what about China? Is China really slowing down?
Whereby I'd just like to mention about the banking system. What very few people still talk about is the time bomb that exists in derivatives. This is, I mean, long-term, a huge problem in my opinion. And I'm not sure how it will be solved, but I suppose that one day there'll be again a crisis. Secondly, there has been an improvement in bank balance sheets, correct? But why? Partly because the banks can essentially get your money on deposit and you don't get any interest, and they can lend it out or speculate with that money and take positions and so forth and so on. So it happens, the banks have improved at the cost of the savers, of the retirees that have, say, large amounts of cash on deposits in money market funds and so forth. They have now no income. So basically the action of the Fed has been biased towards the financial sector and has put savers...
You just got to love his cadence, the way that he talks and the things that he discusses and his absolute nature about his overall opinions, research, and his outlook. And finally up, I want to discuss and bring on back a great guest that we had. This is in a time when Europe was entering into a crisis and there was a concern about Greece going under and all sorts of mayhem and havoc that was being wreaked on Europe on the crisis coming there. Ambrose Evans Pritchard, which was, he's a fabulous writer. Back in September 2013 on episode number 331, we had the opportunity to speak with him.
With us is Ambrose Evans Pritchard, and he is the international economics editor for the London Telegraph. He hasn't been on for some time, and I thought it would be great to get his view from an international perspective. How are you, sir?
I'm very well, thanks.
So there's a lot going on in the international area. A lot of times in the U.S., we focus on what's happening here, but you cover the big picture and some of the things that have been happening, obviously, in Europe and in Asia, et cetera. I know you just had a recent trip to Japan as well. So what's kind of your view of what's happening with all the central bank movements and maneuvers?
Well, I mean, at the moment, everything's kind of hostage to the Fed, because if you really do have a kind of tightening cycle lasting several years in America, that's just going to throw the whole global system out of joint. We're already seeing the first signs of this in emerging market. Just the sheer hint of that the Fed will start draining dollar liquidity to send large parts of the sort of emerging market universe into a tailspin, as we saw, all those countries with current account deficits have suddenly kind of been exposed, and this has been mass capital flight. But it's hardly begun, because the thing to bear in mind is that there have been roughly $4 trillion of investment in emerging markets, foreign funds flowing into there up until 2008, 2009, the Lehman crisis. And that went into real investment and real activity. And then there's been another $4 trillion that went in the last 4 years, basically. And a lot of that was speculative. And it was, low quality investment. It's very fickle. It's going to come out fast.
Mm-hmm.
So we've seen a tiny bit of it. We've seen nothing compared to what could happen if you get some serious capital flight. And they've got more reserves now than they used to have. It's not like, it's not like the Latin American crisis in the early 80s or the Asian crisis in the 90s, when they had pretty small reserves and they'd also fixed their currencies to the dollar, so they got hit twice. This time it's different. They've got large reserves, but they can't actually use them because they're owned for all kinds of complicated reasons. To use them, of course, acts as an internal monetary tightening. That's the mechanism. We start selling reserves. It's the opposite of what they were doing before, which is when they were accumulating reserves, buying all these U.S. foreign bonds and basically holding down their currency. That was effectively causing internal overheating and bubbles in their own countries. They go into do the opposite now. They drain it away, and it's like tightening. So they're tightening into a downward cycle, so they can't actually do it. This is why Brazil is desperately trying to do it through the derivatives markets. They've done about $50 billion of intervention to defend the currency through the derivatives market, trying to pretend, trying to disguise it. Well, okay, and that could build up to $100 billion, and you start getting the real money. they're desperately trying not to do what they have to do, which is actually really defend the currency by really intervening seriously. And there's another point here, that if they start selling all these U.S. treasuries to defend their currencies, they're driving up the U.S. treasury yields.
Yep.
So one of the causes why we've had this sort of 120, 130-point jump in the 10-year U.S. treasury, which is the global price of money, is that all these countries have been selling their treasuries to prop up their own currencies. So you had a negative feedback loop. It was turning into it was kind of a vicious cycle. It was getting worse and worse and worse. That pushed up the U.S. treasury yield even higher. Then they got even more crisis. They then had to intervene yet further. You could see this was turning really, really nasty. And I watched Ben Bernanke's press conference after the FOMC meeting. Mm-hmm. And he was asked about emerging markets. I think they were quite seriously spooked by what happened. And they didn't anticipate it. It kind of blindsided them. And suddenly they realized, my God, this is getting out of control. This is going to come back and bite us. And I think it's a key reason why they recoiled and held off on tapering. Even though they knew this would be a huge shock to markets, it would damage their credibility, they decided it was just too dangerous.
Now, one of the things...
Quite apart from what it was doing internally in the United States, the mortgage market was being hit. There were concerns that was just going to roll over again.
Now, what's interesting is that if you take this to its conclusion of, okay, well, the U.S. has monetary policy that's in, and basically the Fed is pushing money into various fixed income assets, mortgage-backed securities and treasuries. And, everybody's reliant on this. And, you know, obviously the big issue is, I don't want to say a competition, but, you know, with Japan, by doing so, pushes down our dollar, the yen moves up, that's not good for them. So they're going to try hard to move down their currency. Where is the possible exit from this? And I'll just say one other thing. Just the sheer mention of possibly taking a small amount of the bond purchases out is what really started a tailspin in the emerging markets and problems around the world. And how is this? How is it possible that they could ever get out of this?
Well, yeah. I mean, one way to look at QE, everywhere, is you're kind of raising nominal GDP growth. I know that sounds very technical, but that means, you're expanding the economic base on which the debt sits. So you're making sure the economy is the nominal base of the economy is growing faster than the debt. And then you whittle away the debt through this kind of, leisure demand. The opposite of it is a deflationary effect, what they're doing in Europe, where you let the nominal GDP contract in some of these countries like Italy and Spain, and then the debt trajectory just goes through the roof. They go straight towards insolvency and bankruptcy. And that's the track they've been on. So, yeah, okay, you can say, well, if you gradually restore the debt back onto a viable track by doing this, you're actually kind of solving the problem. Because what matters is the ratio of debt.
Mm-hmm.
The burden of it in relation to the size of the economy, that's what matters. It doesn't matter what the absolute amount is. And actually, one of the secret game behind QE is to devalue the debt, make it less of a burden by expanding the nominal base, whittling it away through a little bit of creeping inflation, trying to keep that under control, but you're basically eroding it through this covert means. That's the game. That's what it's all about.
Yeah, but if everybody's doing it at the same time, does it really happen?
Well, that's fine. They all drive down its currencies against each other. The currency effect is a wash. But, that doesn't matter because, that's the secondary effect. What you're really trying to do is prevent what's known in economics as the denominator effect.
Mm-hmm.
It's when the debt load is increasing faster than the base of the economy that supports it. And that'll kill you.
Right.
And that's what's been happening in Europe.
Which is also what happened in Japan.
And It's what happened in Japan. And the problem in Japan, my view, and it's probably not your view, but you know, they did completely the wrong thing in the 90s. I mean, leaving aside, you know, they had a fossilized structure which didn't reform and all of that as well. But they went in for these massive Keynesian fiscal packages of massive spending on everything. Huge deficits, building bridges to nowhere, all the famous, you know, essentially wasted. And they pushed up the debt to 245% of GDP. By the end of it all, that's where they now are, public debt. What they should have done in the 90s is radical monetary stimulus, not these Keynesian expansion spending things. That would have whittled away the debt. They would now have a debt ratio less than 100% if they'd done that.
Mm-hmm.
So they made a mess of it. That was all. It's all because of the mix of policy. You know, do you go for Keynesian fiscal policy on the one hand, or do you go for monetary stimulus on the other hand? And they have completely different effects. And I know people sometimes just conflate the two and think it's all the same, but it's not. It's completely different. They're polar opposites. And what QE, the game of QE is to go for the monetary stimulus, take the burden on off the fiscal side. And what Europe's doing, of course, is the opposite. They're putting all the burden on the fiscal side, and they're going to end up in a mess, in my view. I mean, the disaster that's going to come out of this is going to be Europe, I think, still. I mean, of all the countries involved in this game, they've got the worst policy mix. In the end, it'll come back and bite them. You know, it already has done huge damage. If you look at the chart of the economy in America and in Europe since 2008, the growth, economic growth, real economic growth, they've gone in completely opposite directions. So has the unemployment levels. That is because they had the same shock, basically. The global credit bubble burst. The credit excesses in America and in Europe were roughly comparable in 2008. It was a different composition. It was all the subprime property bubble, etc. In America and Europe, it was this sort of sovereign Club Med Southern Europe bubble.
Mm-hmm.
But it was comparable in scale. They got hit by this shock. They responded differently. You know, production in America's made what roughly 4 or 5% above its peak, Lehman peak now already.
Yep.
In Europe, it's about 4% below. So you've got a massive divergence. Europe's unemployment is at record level. All-time high, and of course, you know, in the mid-high 20s in some of the southern European countries. And in America, it's come right down to 7.3%. It's not great. I know that doesn't tell the whole story. We've got all these other problems, people drifting out of the labor market, the participation rates collapsing, all of that stuff. So it's not a good story in America either. It was a hell of a lot better than what's happened in Europe.
Yeah. Now,
To go into this a bit deeper, into your question, how do they end it? How do they get out of this? Well, I'm pretty sure I know how they're going to get out of it, and nobody wants to admit it. And I've had discussions with people, you know, at a reasonably high level, who sort of kind of talk about this privately, and then they look around their shoulder and hope nobody's listening. that I had that conversation specifically with somebody very influential, and they're never going to sell these bonds.
Mm-hmm.
They will quietly just stop paying interest on them, which is already happening in Britain, in fact, Bank of England's holdings. Then they will quietly change the maturities on the bonds, so they're no longer 10-year bonds. They're sort of permanent, you know, zero coupon bonds into perpetuity until the, you know, kingdom come. And then one day they'll just take them out into a bonfire and, you know, and set fire to them and forget about them. You know, and then just say, well, they never existed. It's just an electronic transfer, boom, it's gone. Flick of a switch.
Does that mean that we can never have a financial crisis again?
Well, what it means is, the reason why you don't, that's called monetizing the deficit, monetizing the debt. And that's a taboo in central banking. And, of course, every hyperinflation in history, that's how it began. They started monetizing the deficit, and the central banks were recruited as an arm of the government to cover the debt, usually in wartime. You know, governments are running huge deficits, so they just got the central bank to start printing the money to cover it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's classic. That's happened so many times around the world. I mean, the history book's full of it. And, of course, it's what happened in Germany in the early 20s. It was a consequence of the First World War. They were living, you know, they ran up huge debts, and then they got, you know... So the Reichsbank basically became an arm of the government. They were just printed money just to cover the government bills every month.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're in a deflationary situation, that Japan's been in is completely the opposite. You know, and actually, we want to be generating some inflation to get out of the hole.
Sure.
And so the point is, you know, in the case of Britain, say, Britain, they bought £375 billion. That's roughly, it's about 27% of the entire public debt of Britain, sovereign debt, has been built by the Bank of England. The Fed's done the same thing in America, a bit less, maybe 18-19%, I don't know what. Japan's going to take it even higher. Japan's, what it's doing right now is so mega, by the end of next year, it'll just be a colossal, probably half. Mm-hmm. I don't know. No, so not half the debt, but it'll be even larger than what the Bank of England's done. So, and if you, at the end of this, you're sitting on these bonds, you've got no inflation to speak of, maybe even falling inflation, well, then the objections to simply monetizing it, just eliminating it, disappear, because what are the objections? The objections are some kind of, it's a religious thing, we shouldn't do it, or, but I mean, who it's a victimless crime. I mean, who's the loser from this? The society as a whole, what you do by doing that, in the case of Britain, say, you simply eliminate 27% of the entire public debt of the country, just like that, at a stroke, flick of a switch. It's a huge, huge benefit to society. You don't have that hanging around you anymore. There are no losers because there's nobody on the other side of the trade. It's purely artificial. Mm-hmm. The central bank, you know, you just cancel it. You send a letter from one institution to another down the road and you say, we eliminate it, we forgive it, end of story. And central banks can do that. They can just create the money electronically, so it's just gone. So the only constraint on this is if it's going to create inflation.
Mm-hmm.
And the other constraint might be, well, if you start behaving like this once, you're going to do it again. You're a serial violator. And you know, you can't trust the central bank that behaves that way. Well, yeah. that's certainly a valid and real objection. But at the end of the day, if you can just conjure away a quarter of your entire debt, if America can just bring its public debt down from 100% to 75%, just like that overnight with the flick of a switch, without creating any inflation, I mean, what exactly is the objection? I didn't fully understand what the objection should be.
I hear you. I just wish companies could do this. Individual companies would be better off if they could do something like this. How great is that? I mean, I want to do it personally.
Yeah, well, America's a sovereign state. It can do whatever it wants. It makes up the rules. So, you sovereign states can do what they want.
Yeah, no, I agree.
You know, the Fed's working for the nation, working for the people, for the taxpayers, for the citizens of the country. If the citizens of the country deem that to be in their interest, well, I don't see the objection. Now, if you start doing favors for individual companies, then you get into all kinds of, you know, you're picking losers and winners. But if you're doing it for a country, it's in the general public interest. There's no kind of discrimination in favor of one person or another. You're just saying the whole nation has its debt burden reduced, and you know, unless somebody can come up with a very good reason why this is a damaging and bad thing to do, what's the objection? I mean, I'm not exactly calling for it. I'm just saying this is where I think it will end up.
Yeah. And by the way, I'm answering
your original question.
Yeah.
This is simply the logic of what's happened.
Yeah, and frankly, my son is studying American history, and one of the things we were talking about is the basic tenets of the Constitution. And one of the tenets is to provide for the welfare of the people, which is just what you said. You know, it is for the sovereign, for the country. But let's move on from this because I just want to talk about Europe for a second. I know we have only limited time here. And there's two things. One of them is that it seems that some of the methodology right now of governments and we'll take out central banks from this for a second. But governments is to do a lot of delaying or at least postponement of things. For example, we've seen that, you have a certain amount of debt target you're supposed to reach by a certain time. And when it comes to that time and you don't reach that level, even though you're not supposed to get additional bailout funds or whatever else was involved in that particular that goal, okay, you get an extra 4 months. You get an extra 6 months. So is that a tactic that is, I guess it's working because, you know, nobody's, it doesn't seem to be a problem. But do you notice that being an issue that has been cropping up?
Well, yeah, I mean, look, it's a huge problem, but it's a huge problem politically. I mean, economically, the part of the problem in Europe has been that they've been doing too much austerity. then it's been self-defeating. We now know from the IMF, from all their studies on fiscal multipliers and so forth, that you've got these high-debt countries in a crisis without their own currency, without their own central bank, and you know, no offsetting monetary stimulus, and you push them through this extreme austerity, that is going to a complete tailspin. And so the actual debt trajectory, instead of getting the debt trajectory has been accelerating upwards, been getting worse at an accelerating rate, the more austerity they do in some of these countries. So it's mm-hmm. completely self-defeating. So we've seen in the last sort of 12 months, you know, the public debt ratio is rising to like sort of 16%, 13%, 12% in some of these southern European countries, 7% in Italy. So it's actually, you know, in a single year. So it's actually not succeeded. So they shouldn't be doing it. Now, the problem is that the whole political contract in Europe is that the European Central Bank will kind of backstop them now. They will prevent them spiraling out of control and going bust. But only if they deliver on the reforms.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole sort of Germany's sort of willingness to go along with the entire game of monetary union at this point
mm-hmm.
is dependent on them being a perception among the German taxpayers and public that these countries are trying and doing their best. And if you start getting a feeling that they're taking advantage of Germany, or they're just stringing Germany along and they're not really getting on with it, and they're just trying to take the money but not do the hard stuff, and if that perception develops in Germany, that could become a crisis. Now, but I was at a conference a couple of weeks ago in Italy, and several people were saying that. I remember Zerlich was saying, the former World Bank chief, was being exactly this point. The whole thing depends on, you know, is Germany going to walk away from this thing because it feels it's being taken advantage of?
Hmm.
So this is why the politics of it is so neuralgic. I mean, I happen to think the German prescription for this is completely wrong. But
really?
There's a reality here that they call the shots. And if they get really unhappy and walk away, then the whole thing's going to collapse.
Mm-hmm.
And this issue's not gone away. And there are all kinds of things that are going to happen in the next few months. I mean, firstly, I didn't buy the line that Europe's really recovering. I think, best it's kind of stabilizing, but it's stabilizing at a level of mass unemployment, which is incredibly destructive for democracies and society. And you just can't have unemployment rates of 26%, 27%, youth unemployment rates of 60% just going on for year after year. It's just intolerable.
Right.
And so I did, stabilization is not good enough. And it's not. And furthermore, stabilization doesn't stabilize their debt levels. And it's they're just galloping upwards. So you're on the cusp in several of these countries, Portugal, I'd say, and Italy have come to mind immediately. We are already at or beyond the point of no return on the debt trajectory, and people just don't want to admit it.
Right.
And you know, another year or two without a proper recovery, even if they sort of manage to eke out, you know, growth of 0.5%, which actually they probably won't. But, I mean, even if they did, it wouldn't be enough. It wouldn't stop this thing just spinning out. So this crisis hasn't gone away.
Right.
It's just, whether it hits. And then there could be endless political triggers, you know, and it could be the Italian government collapsing, you know, it could be the German Constitutional Court, which still has to rule on whether the Bundesbank can take part in these ECB rescues. If they conclude, and there's been some hints about this, strong hints, I mean, the head of the Bundesbank testified in front of the court that this was illegal. This is a violation of the German basic law, constitutional law. Well, if the German court agrees with this, and they say, well, the Bundesbank is forbidden from participating, the whole thing collapses, and then the euro, I mean, who knows what? I mean, can you imagine what would happen if suddenly Germany refuses to...
Ugly.
We'd have an extraordinary situation. All this is hanging over. There's so many things that can happen. And there's so many countries that are sort of hanging on by their fingernails, and they just sort of, this could erupt at any time again. And I suspect that that's partly what was in the back of the minds of the Fed
mm-hmm.
when they met. And they were worried because the last two great sort of spasms of the Eurozone debt crisis followed a period of Fed tightening.
Right.
After QE1, after QE2, when they began to sort of, they suddenly cut off the spigot of stimulus, and they started sort of signaling they were going to be moving to a tightening cycle. And then that just rippled straight through the European debt markets and just set off this, So I think they're quite concerned this could happen again, and they don't feel they're in the clear.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not at all. I don't think the eurozone currency experiment is a viable political experiment anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just causing so much tension. You've got essentially they're in the wrong currencies, and there's still a 20% competitiveness gap between North and South, and you can't disclose that by forcing deflation and cuts on the South, because the deflation causes their debt dynamics to explode. So it's just not a viable. So it mathematically can't be done.
Right.
So you can't. You've just got a complete standoff. You know, Germany's locked in this colossal trade surplus, 7% of GDP, you know, through a kind of a fixed currency system now in Europe, and everybody's trapped. And, you know, when I travel around Southern Europe and I talk to a lot of people, there's incredible bitterness now among the policymakers. They just feel they're locked into this damn thing. They don't know how to get out of it. They think it'd be a total disaster if they leave the euro, forced out of the euro. But they think it's a total disaster if they stay in
it. Right. There's no win. Yeah, I agree. There's neither side, because it depends on which side you're on. I mean, obviously the South is you know, riding the coattails of the North, and the North is aggravated because they have to share their success, if you will, with the South.
Yeah, and I think the German position is completely untenable. I think they're enforcing a kind of gold standard, totally destructive set of policies on Southern Europe. It's repeating all the errors of the interwar years, you know, forcing all the burden of adjustment on the weakest deficit states. So I think it's totally misguided. But I will say this, that the German people have never had it properly explained to them what's going on.
Mm.
They didn't vote for the euro. They didn't want the euro. They wanted to keep the D-mark. They were kind of dragged along into this thing politically by the French and the Italians. They didn't want to do it. And now the whole thing kind of blows up because in their minds, you know, these other countries are not playing by the rules. So I have a huge sympathy for the German citizens in this, that they're now being asked to sort of bail it out the whole damn time. And they're just sort of completely sick of it.
Yeah.
You know, this is the problem with the whole project. It's led to these huge kind of, there's all this sort of bitterness. Everybody's blaming each other. The central problem is structural. It's in the nature of the monetary union itself and the way it was created. There's nobody to blame. It's not because Italians or the Spanish are behaving badly. It's not because the Germans are behaving badly. It's the structure of the thing. It should never have been created. It's unworkable. It's inevitably leading to all these tensions, and these tensions will just carry on and on and on, and they will turn Europe in. Well, they have already turned Europe into quite an unpleasant sort of political place. As we're seeing with this sort of new Greek Nazis and a lot of stuff going on.
Yeah, I hear you.
That's early days yet, I would say. I mean, I was amazed, and I spoke to the foreign policy chief for this new German party, Eurosceptic Party, AfD. He's very nice, but he seems to be talking about secret deals with Russia and giving you giving up Ukraine and saying Poland shouldn't be in NATO, and I mean, really weird stuff. When you begin to wonder, oh my God, are we unleashing something? Have we uncorked something here which we don't really want? This is where it's going. You know, people are furious with the kind of European policy establishment. They're furious with the way they've been dragged into this thing. It's gone way beyond what they ever really wanted. And it's creating a sort of revolt everywhere, these rebellions everywhere, which are quite, which have a slightly unpleasant flavor to them in some places, and that could get dangerous.
Yeah, I hear you. Listen, we could be going on for days because
now that was I thought that was fun. I think that one of my favorite interviews. There've been so many others. You know, we've had on DOS so many times, and we've had names in the area of commodity trading, and Corey Rosenblum for technical analysis, and we've had Barry Ritholtz from The Big Picture, and pretty much all of the Fast Money gang has been on. So if you have the opportunity, maybe now is the time to go check out thedisciplinedinvestor.com, the podcast summary page. Check out what's on there, what you have to listen to, and I think that you'll enjoy it. Well, this ran a bit longer than we have in the past, but I thought we would just bring back some memories of what we had talked about over the last decade. Thank you so much. Thank you so much for listening. Thank you so much for being a part of this, for always providing me feedback. You could always send a note by going over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com, clicking on the Ask Andrew button, and then sending me a comment or a question. And really, it's what it's all about, is being there with you, this may not seem like it sometimes necessarily because I'm talking with guests, but I think it's we're all together here. I feel like we're having a conversation. And that's what's really great about this. Not only the learning, the education, the stock tips, the information, but just the whole ability to share both ways. So thank you so much for that. I'm looking forward to another great 10 years. And I hope you'll be there along the way. Make sure to follow me on Twitter at Andrew Horowitz. And of course, listen to DH Unplugged each and every week, as well as check out everything there is to offer on thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Happy 500ths. Thanks so much. Bye-bye.
The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contains forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.